three of the oldest statesmen in Alaska right there.
Ladies and gentlemen, United States Senator of the great state of Alaska, the Honorable Ted Stevens.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce, once again, my father, Ted Stevens.
Well, thank you, President Stevens, and Speaker Harris, and my gracious daughter-in-law, Elizabeth, for coming to be here. I sort of think I need a footstool up here, Ben. Not as tall as the governor. I do thank you for your invitation to be with you again today. And it really is nice to have a chance to come home and see friends. The other day I spoke with a friend of mine who's writing a book about churches. He toured all the major churches in the United States, from Washington to San Francisco to Seattle and up to Alaska. When he started his trip, he was in a church in Washington, D.C., and he spotted a golden telephone attached to the wall. And above it was a sign that said, "For public use, $10,000 a minute." And he asked the clergyman, "What's this all about? Why? The church clergyman said, "Well, that's there because, and the cost is high because that's an expensive call. It's direct to heaven." But my friend said he saw the same phone in every church as he went across the country. And finally he got up here to Juneau. And he found the church here had a golden phone, but above it, it had a sign, a different sign. It said 25 cents a minute. So he asked the clergyman, "All the other church phones I've seen throughout the country charge $10,000 a minute. How come you can only charge 25 cents? He says, "My son, you're in Alaska now. It's God's country. It's a local call." This is the first time in 37 years, and I have been here 37 years, and I want to depart from the tradition of delivering really quite a lengthy speech. Instead, I hope this will be a dialogue with you about vital issues we, as Alaska's elected representatives, should address to fulfill the promise of this state of ours. And I'll try to be concise in these comments because I want to try to respond to all of your questions and comments. Alaska now faces challenges even greater than those we face in the fight for statehood. 50 years ago, I served as legislative counsel to the Secretary of Interior in the Eisenhower administration, Secretary Fred Seaton. That was a position that enabled me to participate in that fight for statehood. I got that job because of our statehood strategy. Bill Snedden, the publisher of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, knew Fred well, and Bill actually asked him to take me on as his assistant. Our statehood strategy was developed by people like Bill Snedden, Bob Atwood, Ernest Greening, Bill Egan, Bob Bartlett, and others. People with vision, leadership, and a plan. They were willing to dedicate their time and energy to our cause. They were conscious of the incentives that would lead to statehood and foster economic growth. And all of us worked together without regard for politics. Our state leaders have had a long history of reaching out to Congress and the lower 48. Those who fought for statehood were the opinion leaders of Alaska of their day. They educated Americans about the benefits statehood would provide. I remember Bill Snedden talking to Henry Luce, the editor of Time magazine in New York City. Bob Atwood speaking with Randolph Hearst. And in later years, even Red Boucher, then lieutenant governor of our state, traveled from state legislature to state legislature, personally, during the seven-year battle over Alaska lands. Now is the 25th year of the battle over Anwar. And we need people like Snedden and Atwood and Boucher and all the others, Greening and Bartlett and Rivers. Alaskans who are willing to speak with the press and others to make our case heard. Unfortunately, other than in Ketchikan, there are no publishers like Snedden or Atwood who are willing to be advocates for our state instead of critics. It is difficult to get federal support now because of our image in Washington. Many see our projected $1.4 billion annual surplus, plus the $34 billion in the permanent fund, and they see the increasing price of electricity, gasoline, and heating oil. So they ask us, why should we send federal money to Alaska when they're not willing to spend their own funds? It was that feeling that prompted the attack by Senator Coburn on our funding in the highway bill. It was that feeling that fueled the media coverage of his attack. These people do not understand our state, our challenges, or our opportunities. They believe already we get too much federal aid. This creates difficult problems for Lisa, Don, and me in Washington. Really, our state's economic future, our economic potential, is extraordinary. The list of possibilities for that is staggering. We have two-thirds of the outer continental shelf of the United States, a great portion of which is reported to hold significant oil and gas reserves and not a producing oil well out there. We have an enormous potential of gas hydrates, an estimated 32 trillion cubic feet of gas hydrates under our state's permafrost. Between 40 and 100 trillion cubic feet are beneath the oil and gas infrastructure which already exists on our North Slope. And we have half the coal of the United States. The question is, can we convince Congress to invest in coal gasification projects and the commercialization of gas hydrates and share OCS revenues? The answer, I'm sad to tell you, is without state investments in those projects, probably not. We have the gas pipeline, ANWR, and NPRA. All involve great potential future state income and all have strong opponents. I believe Alaska must proceed carefully because most of these opportunities involve federal land, and Congress will have a role in each of these possibilities. We need and we want, I believe, also the support from Congress. But we compete with many areas of the world for private investment to develop these tremendous opportunities. Industry and those in Congress must understand how Alaskans feel about this potential future in economic development. There must be a favorable climate for investment in this state. What happens in this legislature is extremely important. It greatly will impact the future investment decisions and also the support that we can get in Washington. It's a difficult period for the federal government. I bet you don't know that engaged in a worldwide war on terror, our nation has 2.6 million men and women in uniform, and they serve in 146 countries today, including our own here at home. They're all actively working to defeat terrorism. In my judgment, what our U.S. military accomplishes in the war against terror now could well determine the future of civilization. This is a war, a world war, that we cannot afford to lose. And until it's over, the fiscal climate in Washington is going to be strained because our priority is and must continue to be to provide for our troops, provide them with the equipment and the resources they need. Thank you. We have an increasing national debt. It's over $8 trillion. That's a constant constraint on federal spending. Since 2001, The interest expense alone has totaled nearly $1.5 trillion. And there are great concerns about the impact this will have on economic growth in the future in our nation. The debate over congressional earmarks, in which I'm very much involved, is still ongoing. Without question, however, there will be real changes in the way Congress appropriates federal money. If the initiatives here in Alaska, which began as federal earmarks, are to continue, and you're not going to like this, state matching funds may be required. Many federal grants and programs are based on the extent to which a state demonstrates local support by committing state funds. Going forward, I hope we will work together to demonstrate Alaska's support for expanding economic development. For instance, I'm sure you know, the state has not provided the Denali Commission with any financial support, yet half the decisions are made by the state. The future of our state will depend upon our ability to strengthen our partnership with the federal government. Avian flu is a good example of the challenge that demands federal and state cooperation. Our state is a central hub for trans-Pacific migratory birds and international travel. Alaska is the most likely entry point, as we all know, for avian flu into the United States. Residents of some of our native villages harvest these birds and their eggs for subsistence purposes. State and federal resources will be needed to adequately prepare for this threat. The Secretaries of Health and Human Services, Interior and Agriculture unveiled a nationwide early detection plan 2 days ago. I will meet with Secretaries Leavitt, Norton, Johans, and, well, others, upon my return to Washington to discuss how their plan affects our state. And I've also urged federal agencies to open labs here in Alaska capable of performing rapid testing on these birds. It now takes much too long. We have to send the specimens to Minnesota and then down somewhere in the southeast. On the state level, Alaskans need to be educated about how to handle these birds, especially those who will come in contact with them as part of subsistence activities. But let me commend, and I do commend, the State of Alaska Division of Public Health for their draft response plan, which outlines the actions which must be taken to prepare for a pandemic. Efforts are now underway at the Department of Health and Human Services to convene a pandemic flu summit right here in our state. Over 400 people will be asked to participate in this summit, and I urge you here in the legislature to determine which activities the state should handle and which activities will require federal resources. The draft response plan points us in the right direction, and it's my hope that you'll be able to figure out how to execute this plan and report your findings to the summit in April when it meets. Now, despite all I've said, I'm a little wary at times of giving advice. When tempted, I remember a story about a school paper written by a young girl on the life of Socrates. You've all heard about Socrates too, I'm sure. Socrates, she wrote, was a Greek philosopher who went around giving people advice. They poisoned him. Nevertheless, Alaska needs a plan, a roadmap for the future, and we should all work together. The plan, the incentives, the vision must be Alaskan. All must come from the people of our state. No one else should be allowed to determine our future. As it was in the days when we fought for statehood, it's up to each of us here to be able to explain and defend Alaska's plan. Our state's opinion leaders must be a force in history, as were our predecessors in the statehood days. In the territorial days, men like Bill Snedden, Bill Egan, Bob Atwood, Ernest Greening, all the others as I've mentioned, demonstrated to the rest of the country what it meant to be Alaskan. Your challenge, I feel, is to become the next generation's great leaders. I'm not blowing in your ear. The decade ahead is a proving ground. It's going to be a tough road. We can only realize our promise and ingenuity if we realize the potential with strong leadership and a favorable climate for investment. My friends, it really is up to you to lead the way in the decisions you make this year north to the future. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have. sirs.
Thank you. Questions we give Senator Huggins.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, my question for you today is on the subject of earmarks, but before I do that, I would like to say thank you for yesterday. I had the opportunity to introduce a couple of staffers here from the legislature, and one of those, particularly Josh Temple, who works for me as a staffer, was very impressed, and I guess the term awestruck would... But you're greeting those people, and I say thank you very much for that. In the case of earmarks, we've heard a number of accounts of that. We've read other accounts. How does the process of the potential change in earmarks, how does that impact Alaska and Alaskans?
Well, earmarks really are very difficult to define in total. We get requests from the president in his budget. And we review the budget in both House and Senate, and we prepare a budget resolution. And that budget resolution then goes to a conference between the House and Senate, and that budget resolution comes up with a congressional budget, and that's what is our guideline. Our points of order and our procedural concepts in the Congress in both House and Senate are decided by our budget, not by the president's request. But when we seek to change the president's budget, our congressional budget would set a ceiling, and in the Senate, if you want to go above that ceiling, you have to have 60 votes to have an item go in above the ceiling set by the Senate. But the situation is, let's take, for instance, if I want to change some money that's in one of the agencies that the president has asked for money for housing for federal employees, and we look at it and say, well, that's not as high a priority for us as building a bridge across this river to get into an area where there's an increase in tourism. So I would ask the committee to delete this item and add this item, and to say that money, as it's added, will be earmarked for the bridge, okay? Now, that process of earmarking is under severe attack. Most of the people making the attacks have never served on the Appropriations Committee, don't understand the process, I'll tell you. And many forget the problem of the First Amendment. The First Amendment says that people in the United States shall have the right to petition Congress for the redress of wrongs. And you know, Congress is part of that government as well as the executive branch. But this fight on earmarks makes sacrosanct the president's budget, which is really made up by a bunch of people around the offices all over the country, and they send in requests. They go through the regional office, into the bureau, into the you know, the departmental level. They then send a departmental request to the Bureau of the Budget. They review it, and they've got a whole series of people that make changes in it, and they send it up to us. But we've got too many people in Congress who now believe that is sacrosanct, whereas it's something that I might say about how to spend federal money in Alaska is not. I think the outcome of that may be livable. If it requires transparency and accountability. One of the things that's really been under attack has been the changes that are made in conference. When we're in conference, and you know, you've got to remember the president's budget starts in about August of, say, the first year, and then it comes through the budget's process and comes through the whole government for the next year, and then in February of really the third year, but it's only about 18 months total time, the president sends a budget to us. As we look at it through the year, and we come up to the final portion of the year, and usually the appropriations process finishes in September of each year, we take a look at the requests that started way back then in August of 2 years before, and we're actually appropriating money for the future year, you understand. This would be, say, this would be 04, it comes to 05, it comes to us in 06, and we're really talking about the budget for 07. So we say, look, we found that there have been lawsuits on this subject. There's something wrong. There's been a fire. There's been a flood. There's been something. We don't want to spend that money that way. We want to spend it another way. So, and we make that determination quite often in a conference committee when both the House and Senate come together. You guys have conference committees. And we change items in conference. It's the items that have been changed in conferences or added in conference under the earmark process that are most greatly under attack, and I think we will be severely limited by what we can do in conference. I think it's unfortunate, but it's part of the current feeling brought about by that deficit I mentioned. Too many people think we can change the future by changing the spending side of our federal government. The appropriations process really handles about 25% of the total spending, 75% of it is determined either by the amount of money we have to spend for interest or the amount of money that goes to entitlements. Veterans benefits, Social Security, all the things are in the area of what we call entitlements, or in tax benefits where people get the ability not to send in the money they should send in under the tax laws. So it's going to be a tremendous fight in the balance this year. I think earmarks will survive because they've got to survive. And I think if the Congress goes too far, the courts will tell us we've gone too far. We do not have the right, I feel, to deny the people the right to ask us to redress wrongs. And for people who need help, the answer is to go to your House member or your senator and ask them to change the budget and have the money be spent in different ways. It's going to affect us because as a new state, I'm talking a long time on this, but after I became chairman of the Appropriations Committee, I found many programs we didn't even know existed. They were in departments that I had not been in the subcommittees as you move through the Appropriations Committee, the 13 subcommittees, and I never was on the Agriculture Committee. But we found that the agriculture had water and sewer for rural areas. And we needed water and sewer in the rural area of Alaska. So I came up with earmark, and I earmarked part of the money that was in the bill for water and sewer projects in Alaska. I later found that money, when they spent it, someone from the federal government went to the area office, then the regional office, then we had an area office. We do have an area office for agriculture in the state. And they tried to determine how to spend that money. And before they were through, they spent more than 45% of the money in administrative costs, and about 55% was going in the ground. So the next year, I said, let's create the Denali Commission. Turn that money over to the Denali Commission and let them spend it with a 5% limit on overhead. Now, all of this is now subject to real criticism, but again, small states don't have the luxury of having so many congressmen that you cover all of the areas of the appropriations process. And there are still programs out there, I'm sure, that I really have never been able to totally understand what governs the spending process, things that we should be getting money out of that we don't get. And it's only the earmarking process that will ever get us there, because we just have the three of us out of the 535 people who represent the American public in the Congress. Oh, that's a long answer, my friend. I hope it helps you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Roachberg.
Senator, it's great to welcome you home again. But I just really would like to say that you led a valiant fight for the passage of ANWR last December. But the Senate recently passed a budget resolution that sets up an ANWR-only reconciliation bill. What do you think the chances are of that passing this year, and what can we as legislators do to help you meet that goal?
Well, it's on the same path as we took last year. We had under our budget act, we have we bring up a budget resolution. The budget resolution determines what legislation is necessary to fulfill the budget. That then calls for a reconciliation act, which brings forth the legislation to accomplish that. And that's the one set of bills that's not subject to filibuster in the Senate. So we've got this budget resolution going forward now, and it has to be approved by the House. The House, some people in the House have already announced they're not going to support the budget resolution, even though the only reconciliation activity involved in this year's budget resolution, because we did most of it last year for this two-year period, is in fact the energy portion of which ANWR is a part. We know already that there's a substantial number of members of the House that have announced that they're going to oppose the rule. Now, in the House, when you take a budget resolution to the floor, you must have a rule. That allows and sets for the bill to go to the floor and sets the parameters of debate on the floor and what amendments are allowed to that bill. That's how they solve their problems. They don't have a filibuster concept, but they have the ability to stop a bill by not granting a rule. And that happened to us last year on the reconciliation bill we sent to the House from the Senate. It could not get a rule because the Democratic Party took the position that it would not vote at all for that reconciliation bill. And there are enough Republicans that opposed ANWR that they wouldn't vote for the rule either. So that failed in the House. As a consequence, a bipartisan group came to me and said, "You're the manager of the Defense Appropriations Bill. Put that in the Defense Appropriations Bill, and we'll guarantee it will pass the House. We want ANWR." So they sent that over to the House, and then you saw the process. We then developed a partisan filibuster in the Senate, and I don't want to really be accused of being too hard on those here members of the Democratic Party. But the one problem is that the leadership of the House and the Senate follow the platform of the Democratic Party. Since President Clinton vetoed Anwar, people forget Anwar passed in 95. He vetoed it. In 1996, the Democratic Party put a provision in their platform against Anwar. And as a consequence, with the backing of the people who have been presidential candidates, the leadership of the Democratic Party in House and Senate oppose any vote on Anwar. Now, we've got to find some way to get around that in terms, we'll pass it in the Senate, but the problem will be in the House. What can you do? Again, you're not going to like me too much today. None of you brought any darts, did you? Give us some more money for Arctic Power this year. Yeah, I've seen people holding their head. This is the time. Believe me, it is the time, because we've got to get this through now. The international oil industry we're dealing with is in Russia, they're in Qatar, they're in Indonesia, they're all over the world. And they've stood with us for 25 years in trying to get Anwar open. If we fail again this time, I don't think they're with us at all anymore. And I'm serious, and I've talked to a lot of them. We must get this done. There was a commitment was made by Senators Jackson and Senator Tsongas in 1980 to me personally. Unfortunately, two of them suffered a premature death, and we're not there to help carry out their commitment that we would see drilling in that area. If you want to talk about history, the bill, the 1980 bill, passed the House and the Senate, went to conference, passed for the Senate, and in 1980, before the election, President Carter said, "Don't send it to me. If you do, I'll veto it." So the House didn't send it to him. After he lost the election, they did send it to him, and he signed it. It became law, but it's become a target of the extreme environmental movement since that time because of Anwar. Now, we either overcome that opposition this year, and I think there are ways to do it. But the ways to do it are to remind the American public of the increased cost in electricity, of diesel oil, of gasoline, and who is standing in their way. It's the partisan people who won't vote for it, or those who are following the advice of the extreme environmental movement. Now, one or the other has got to get out of the way of the American public. But we have to alert the American public, and we have to do it in the next month or two. So I urge you, support Arctic Power. Put some constraints on how they spend the money. I won't blame you about that, but I hope you put up the money. And I'm going to call on the American oil industry to come forward and add to that too. This is the year to make the decision. And I really do believe if we don't get it through this Congress, it'll be a long time before we ever again get it in the budget resolution.
Thank you. Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Welcome back home, Senator. And on behalf of most Alaskans, we appreciate what you do for us. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council has been a great tool and has been able to set great standards nationwide and worldwide for fish management. And I was wondering what the status is of the reauthorization and what the future steps would be for the Magnuson-Stevens Act also.
Senator Noe and I introduced a bill to renew the Magnuson-Stevens Act. We've had our hearings. We reported it out of our committee. We now have the support of the people from New England. We're trying to move the principles that have worked so well in the North Pacific Council, make them available to the councils, other councils, regional councils throughout the country. New England objected to that, but we've now settled that by saying those are extended. They're not mandatory, but they can pursue them, and they have the authority to pursue them. Basically, it is extending scientific management of fisheries and asking the industry and the councils to listen to the scientists. We have done that here. We don't have one endangered or one threatened species of commercial fish in the North Pacific Council area. So what we're trying to do is to share our experience and knowledge and our success with the rest of the country, and I think that when we get back in April, the bill will pass the Senate. I know there's a similar bill coming out of the House. It's almost follows our bill, so we ought to be able to get that bill done this year. Thank you.
Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. Thanks for coming here to Juneau, Senator. You know, not too long ago, you were in Diomede. I was up in Nome at the time, and the people there were very proud of your visit.
Here's my friend. I can't hear you.
Not too long ago, you were in Diomede, and the people there were very proud of your visit. I was in Nome at the time. I believe since then, anyway, and McCain have been in Alaska. And I was wondering, do you foresee any traveling U.S. senators in a bush in Western Alaska this year that the Bush could welcome with their traditional welcome and hospitality?
Yes, President Clinton, Senator Kent Clinton and Senator McCain were up that way. I don't know where they visited. I took some senators up there last year, and I went up and through there in August myself. I think one of the real sad things about that area is the damage that was suffered by those 16 villages, nine of which are very badly harmed. And just before the hurricanes of the Gulf and through that area there of Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi and Florida, there was such an enormous demand for money that we haven't really gotten the money we should we'd get from the federal government to help them through their disaster. But I try to get people up there. Every year I bring some members and try to insist that they go up the West Coast with us. And I think it would be good for you to take a trip. I don't know, how many of you ever really have gone up and down the West Coast? So all the villages. Point Hope, Chisholm, Kivalina. Well, you know, let me tell you, if you want to be one of those future years leaders I talked about, you've got to know the state. When I was in Fairbanks in the 50s, our Lions Club took to ourselves, we chartered an old DC-3, we went out to see Barrow, we went out to see McGrath, we went around the area of the Arctic, and it started my education. And I think that unless you understand the problems out there and the potential, don't forget the great potential. The greatest, one of the greatest potentials we have in this state today is the NPRA and the potential leasing of NPRA for the future. But I appreciate your question. Look forward to being up your way.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, you know that in my career I've moved a lot of iron and steel, and I wanted to switch just a minute to the gas pipeline and wonder if you could give us some insight on the national effect of building that gas line would have in terms of job creation and also in steel production on a national basis to build that project.
Well, it's always glad to have to get a question from a used car salesman. I was reminded yesterday of that story that a friend of mine who knew Huey Long well told me about Huey Long. And he was campaigning one year for governor, and he came to this town, what was the hometown of his opponent, who was a used car salesman. And Huey's reported to have said it. Now, speaking in public, he said, "Why, I know I'm here in John's hometown, and if you wanted to buy a used car, you'd go down his lot and take use that car that's on his lot." And he knew everything about it, and it'd be a grand salesman. You'd really enjoy visiting with him. He said, "But if you want to see two cars, you wouldn't go to John's lot because he cannot handle a two-car deal." I'm glad you can handle a multiple deal, my friend. But you know, the reason that I hope we get around to talk about oil taxes here in a minute, but the reason they're important is because right behind them is the largest project financed by private capital in the history of the world, the Alaska Gas Line. And unless that gas gets to mid-continent before the LNG does from both Atlantic and Pacific coasts, the market for Alaska's gas may disappear. We don't have enough gas, really, in the long run to compete with a vast amount of LNG that's going to enter the world's market. But we have enough gas to compete in the mid-continent for the gas that's needed by the farmers and the people who live in the mid-continent. And if it gets there in time, it will be the one basic part of our economy where there's going to be competition as to the price of gas. That's why so many people are interested. You know, I got a letter from 18 members of the House and the Senate saying, "Where is the gas pipeline? What are you doing?" And they've now demanded a report every 6 months from us on the gas pipeline. So what you're working on in terms of working on oil pricing is to try and settle that issue in order that you can get the gas pipeline. And if you know history, then you know the reason that the producers requested that process. Because once in the past, when there was an arrangement, an understanding, and very few years later, that understanding was broken. Now, this gas pipeline is extremely important to us. I think not only to us, but I hope you'll keep in mind on that we're competing for steel with the Azerbaijan pipeline, the pipeline from Russia, the pipeline through Brazil, to South America. We've even explored the idea of bringing flat steel to Alaska and rolling it here, because the real problem is trying to get steel rolled pipe of the right dimension from anywhere in the world in terms to meet the needs for this pipeline. But time is of the essence in terms of our using, I guess, 35 trillion cubic feet in the ground. It's been there because there's not been a transportation mechanism. We have an Alaskan that came back and testified in Washington last week and said we were all conspiring to keep it in the ground in order to raise the price. Nothing could be further than the truth. We just have not had the ability until the price of gas and oil went up, really, to foresee the ability to repay the cost of that pipeline. Last year, we were told it was somewhere around $20 billion. Early this year, the figure was around $25 billion. This last week, I was told you'll soon see that the estimate for that gas pipeline is $30 billion. Now, if any more delay, and it'll be out of the scope of the ability to pay for it. So I urge you, and I've just been up talking to the governor, this is something that must be done by this legislature, both oil pricing and the gas line. And it's extremely important, not only to our future, but it's absolutely important. Those were primary people from farm states that wrote us that letter. And I hope you'll all realize the urgency those people feel. The price of gas has come down a little bit right now, but you know, it peaked up to about, what, $15? Now it's down to about $7.50. And we were selling gas from the Kenai when I was sitting in one of those that chair for 5 cents an MCF. 5 cents. And selling for $7 right now in the South 48. Well, this is the time that money's there to finance these lines and get them done. It'll be to our great advantage to get it done. Thanks, my friend.
Representative Cott, then Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Welcome back home, and it's always a pleasure to see you, and I really appreciate you bringing some of D.C.'s weather with you.
They've got Alaska weather down there, you know that.
Senator, as this body and the other body contemplates the ratification of Alaska stranded gas contract, and once we complete that, we'll then perhaps throw the ball back into D.C.'s court, and specifically FERC. Can you kind of give us an idea of the timelines and the challenges that contract may face in FERC as it relates to the permitting process and the final approval?
I'm glad you asked that. I should have put it in the last answer. I asked the active people, the top administrative people, not the political people, administrative people of the five agencies that will handle a gas pipeline at the federal level to come visit with me and my staff. EPA, Energy, Interior, was it the Corps of Engineers? Help me, Karina.
FERC.
FERC, yeah. By the way, we in the gallery back there is George Lowe, my chief of staff, Dr. Lindsay Hayes, who's my speechwriter and general advisor, Karina Waller, she's from Anchorage,
Ken.
Yeah. He's my great new counsel, the new general counsel of the Commerce Committee, and I'll catch hell for this. Because sitting next to him is Katrina now, you know what I mean? She's Karina when she's calm, she's Katrina right now. But anyway, the answer to that question, it's difficult to portray what they did. When they came in, they said, Senator, you know, in the bill that you and Senator Murkowski passed, there's an 18-month permitting process. And I said, yes, we're looking forward to that. What's the holdup? They said, well, we want to outline and show you our plans for the pre-permitting process. And I said, pre-permitting? There's nothing in our law that says pre-permitting. They said, you just don't understand. Under existing law, we have these duties. And for us to complete our duties, will take 44 months. And after that month, 18 months on the federal level. Now, we can't get to that federal level until you finish. The state owns this ground, owns this gas. You're like any other private owner until the state agrees it can be moved. There is no federal jurisdiction. It has to be ready to move in interstate commerce before we're involved. So we can't start that process, and I can't start using my club on those guys until you act. And I have talked to the Vice President and other people in the administration, and we're going to shorten that time frame. How much we can shorten, a lot depends on when we get to it. But I do believe, this one person I said, you know, it's coming down the corridor for the oil pipeline into the Fairbanks area, and I said, you know, I can walk from Fairbanks to the border in less than 5 days. Why would you want 44 months? As a matter of fact, this pipeline will be not more than 2,000 yards from the highway all the way along. There's no reason for that delay. Now, the industry itself may have some problems, and the problems may be in design, and they may be in how to handle a pipe. Where are we going to deal with the pipe, and how quickly can they get it? They're not going to really put their money down, I don't think, starting a gas pipeline until they know they can get the pipe. But they won't start that until you all are finished. So it's absolutely essential, as I said, for you to finish this gas pipeline this year. Please, it's just absolutely necessary.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. I have a kind of a regional question. Southeast, over the last several years, about a decade now, have been moving forward with the state's help and the federal help to build electrical intertie, and there's some interest in pushing the intertie from Southeast into Canada to help Washington's electrical needs, and I was wondering if we can have a few of your thoughts on the intertie issue here in Southeast. Thank you.
Well, we have provided a substantial amount of money in the past from the federal government to help with that intertie. It's run into some problems, as you know. It's run into some problems primarily because, again, the lack of local support. I don't think you're going to get much more money from the federal government until this legislature decides it's going to fulfill the commitment that was made in the first place about what was going to be put in there with state funds to build that intertie. It's not something that they will go ahead of us. We said there was going to be so much local money infused in this, and we asked for money to make it. Ultimately, it was to be a complete intertie. I was looking here to see. I think I had a paper on that, but I know the conclusion. The conclusion is there's not going to be much more federal money until we see that the legislature is going to put up the money to do its part for that intertie. You don't like me, do you?
Senator,
I understand you. You want to save more money. I'd like to save more money, too. But I hope you realize how much money is out there. I told someone yesterday, it's like all of us are standing right near the edge of a cliff. And right across that, it's not too far across, is another plain. And on it, it's a land of opportunity. And the question is are we going to just fall off that cliff, or are we going to take the actions necessary to build a bridge over to the future? You cannot, you know. I know the Alaskan public wants more and more money in a permanent fund and permanent dividend, but there's more money for your children and grandchildren in the things I mentioned to you than you will ever get, no matter how much you put in the permanent fund now. What we need to do is have the... And I was in the office with in the Captain Cook with Jay Hammond when we talked about the first permanent fund. I have supported all along. I am not saying that, but I don't think you ought to put any more money in that fund than is necessary to keep the commitments to Jay Hammond's heritage, but to get the money into the areas that will take us into that future. Take the OCS, for instance. 2/3 of the Outer Continental Shelf is off our coast. And one of the problems is going to be, is are we going to get any the revenue from that when it starts? We can if we start now indicating we're willing to think about proceeding with the development of the OCS. Or the Agrium project in Kenai. We're getting some money to help that project. That's coal gasification. If we can gasify our coal with half the coal of the United States, we can move gas. It's harder than the devil to move all that coal out there. coal gasification plants around this state. But that one is the demonstrations project for this new process. It is the one national one, but it requires local support. Or take the other projects that we've got. I've already talked about ANWR, the NPRA process. That, by the way, is going to take some local expenditures out there. They're going to have runways and have to have some access up there. And we're going to have to work with the Department of Interior to make sure we have a basic understanding of how much are we going to be able to put out the lease, because I think that will be, in the future, one of the hottest areas for leases in this country. But we need to make sure that you will put up the money to do the things we have told Congress we will do. And that intertie is a good example. You have not financed that the way it should have been financed.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. President. And on behalf of the people that I represent on the North Slope, Senator Stevens, I just want to thank you for drawing attention to those people up there that you visited so long ago. Two questions. One has to do with, is Arctic Power adequately funded in the past? Has it been adequately funded in the past? And the other thing you alluded to was the NPRA development that is going on. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the impact aid to those villages that has been put forth by you.
I think we've all put a lot of money in Arctic Power. I've used my time many instances in years gone by to help raise money for Arctic Power. I'm really not satisfied with the way that the money has been spent, if you want to know. I do think there ought to be some greater control over it, and that we ought to have much more understanding where the money's going to be spent before you put the money up. I've got ideas how it's done. You might disagree with you. You're going to put up the money. You'll make the decision how it's spent in the long run. But I've been happy with the level, but as in the past, I didn't have the sense of urgency I have now. I really have the feeling now that we succeed this year, or it'll be years before we get back to where we are now again. Did you know that, and again, not getting political, maybe we'd like to hear the politics. Every Republican senator elected since Clinton vetoed that bill has been pro-ANWR. And the majority of them defeated a Democrat who opposed ANWR. Now, that process is going to continue. And another 4 years, I think we'll be able to beat the filibuster. Once we can beat the filibuster, the House will pass ANWR, by the way, as a standalone free bill any time. They can get it done. They've done it several times. The problem is the filibuster in the Senate or the rule in the House. We just haven't been able to get around them. But give me two more elections, and I'll have enough votes in the Republican side to pass ANWR without a filibuster.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was going to hold off on this question, but since my friend...
Since here, I got political, you're going to come at. Go ahead.
You bet, having worked for you. You've been there a long time. You're the President Pro Tem of the Senate. You spoke to us about our duty to be a leader. I want to know how partisanship is affecting Congress and how the parties need to work together to make things work. Tell us how it should work.
Well, my friend, and you're a very good lawyer on my staff and still a good friend, I'm sad to tell you I think I've never lived through a period of partisanship like it exists today. I bet you don't know that the former leader, Senator Daschle, has started a project called the Senate Majority Project. And he has a blogger that works every day, and you can pick him up. I pick him up once in a while. And he's attacking those who are not up for election this time, but those who will be up for election next time. Starting the progress, and he and his colleague in the Senate, Senator Reid, who's been a friend for years, have said that I'm part of the culture of corruption. And they said that because after this Abramoff thing, we found as we went back that I had received a $1,000 contribution from that person. And we sent it back. Now, Harry Reid got many thousands. He didn't send it back. But their blogger says, I'm part of the Senate because I am an associate of that person. This politics has reached the point now, and by the way, there's some on our side. Some on our side, there's extreme people on our side who are going after those who are running in the Democratic Party. And I think it's reached the point of just absurdity. But it is a time now of just total accusation. Of the 38 bills that have come out of the committee that Senator Inouye and I chair, we are co-chairs, by the way, and I would advise you sometime try it. It works. Yes. Make sure that you have a good friend and try to get something done on a bipartisan basis, and it works. But of the 38 bills we brought up, 16 of them have holds on them. You know what hold is? That means one senator says, if you call up that bill, I'm going to go object, and if I object, I'm going to lead a filibuster, and if I lead a filibuster, it's going to take Senate's time, so why take up that bill? Now, that's partisanship. In the days when I first went there, as you know, my close friends were Senator Warren Magnuson. He called me son. Senator Stennis called me boy. Scoop Jackson and I were friends, and I traveled with him this month after month, and we did many things on a bipartisan basis. I think the only two that's left today, and I have that relationship with Dan Inouye, not myself. And I'll close by telling you, I leave tonight, going to fly all night, going to go to Honolulu to the funeral of my good friend's wife, passed away. He and I are the last two of that type. Mansfield and Scott were that type. We've had close friendships across the aisle in the past, but I think many people are trying to pull us apart because they don't like the fact that we are running contrary to this trend of just extreme partisanship. But I would urge you all, you know, some of the best friends I still keep in touch with from my days here sat on that side of the aisle. And we took time to make sure that we knew each other and stayed with each other and saw each other in between sessions. This state cannot survive with a partisan divide. And as I spoke to you, and I remember the people from the statehood days again. You know, Bob Bartlett was a great friend of mine when I was with Fred Seaton. Ernest Greening, I bet you don't know, after he was defeated, came to me and said, Ted, I can't afford to, I just can't stand standing home, say home. I need some place to come to the Senate. I said, well, Ernest, take that room, and we'll give you a secretary. This state can only survive, and I don't want to get too modern about it, if we're Alaskans first and politicians second. And I hope you all live up to that.
Senator Stevens?
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that this joint session stand in adjournment.
Thank you. Joint session is adjourned.
The House will stand at ease, waiting the departure of the Senate, and then we will be back where we left off.